from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll learn about female Jewish comedians who paved the way for women in comedy. Then we'll tell you about a documentary that explores the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa's battle against the Line 5 pipeline.
I think in our country, we sort of take it for granted, the access we have to water. It's not a tragedy until it's gone. You know, people don't pay attention until there's tragedy.
We'll learn about Golda Meir and how living in Milwaukee influenced her decades-long political career in Israel.
She was less of a thinker than a doer. But as a doer, she showed the capacity to fulfill virtually any role, and people knew that she was reliable.
Plus, we'll tell you about Marquette's annual Dreamers Gala. All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel on Amazon Prime explores the fictional life of a female stand-up comedian in the late 1950s. But while Midge Maisel is fictional, the character is rooted in the real-life history of female Jewish comedians who made their way to the top of the comedy scene despite many obstacles. That history will be explored tomorrow evening at UW-Milwaukee in a lecture called The Many Mrs. Maisels, The History of Jewish Female Stand-Up Comedians, presented by Grace Kessler-Overbeck. She joins me now to talk about it. Grace, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me.
So one of the critiques I've heard of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel is that this just couldn't happen, it didn't happen, but your lecture really disproves that notion. When we're looking at the history of specifically Jewish women in comedy and stand-up, when does that story really start?
Well, you could start the story as early as vaudeville in like the turn of the century. When you look at Jewish women comedians, I think they're standing on the shoulders of so many Jewish women singers who did really, really funny musical numbers like Fanny Brice or Sophie Tucker. And I mean, they were both really important vaudeville stars. So I think you could make a case for the Maisel lineage starting, I mean, at least in the 1910s, if not earlier.
When it comes to, you know, comedy and stand-up, who are some of the first women who we see emerging in the comedy scene in the 1950s, the 1960s?
So my personal favorite and the subject of my book, actually, is Jean Carroll. She is the first Jewish woman to do stand-up as we understand stand-up today. So there's no musical numbers, there's no sketches, it's just a person speaking from their individual point of view about their experiences in a really funny way. And she started doing that really as early as the 1940s because she was an MC. So a lot of stand-up emerged out of MCs who would introduce acts in variety shows.
How would you describe her early kind of stand-up to people who might be more familiar with the kinds of stand-up we have now?
It's not a different species from the stand-up that we have now, but it might be like a grandparent in that she was one of the really, really early people to get personal with her stand-up. The earliest, earliest stand-up was sort of like reciting a joke book. You know, you would just kind of tell joke after joke after joke, and stand-ups could steal material from one another because the jokes weren't really connected to any kind of personal experience. But around Jean Carroll's time and what she was part of was this transition into what we now think of as stand-up, which is way more personal. It's almost like giving a confession. It's like really leaning into your own experiences and your own personal point of view.
Well, and that feels very Mrs. Maisel. For people who might not be familiar with the show, much of the stand-up that she does in The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel is based on her life. I can't really think of, in fact, any stand-up sets that she does that isn't based in her life.
Right. And I think that that's one of the really exciting things about stand-up. And it's one of the reasons I think that so many people from minoritized backgrounds have been drawn to stand-up. because it's a way to give your perspective. It's a way that a different point of view can be really valuable.
You mentioned, of course, Jean Carroll. There were other women who were also doing stand-up at this time. But even today, stand-up comedy more generally is often a boys' club. If you go to an open night, you're going to see a lot of men and maybe just a couple women. What were some of the unique issues that women faced, especially when compared to their male counterparts?
Well, in the 1950s, there was just a illegibility. Like, it's really funny to read reviews of Jean Carroll and some of her contemporaries. I will say there's not a lot in the way of stand-up, like women doing stand-up in the 1950s. In the 1960s, then you had like Phyllis Diller and Joan Rivers, and there were a few more. But a lot of the time, women were allowed to do comedy if they were singing, but there had to be a musical component. And a lot of critics, when reviewing Jean Carroll, will comment, I'm like, there are no songs. Where are her songs? She just talks. And they're extremely puzzled by this. I think just establishing herself as like, no, I'm doing stand-up comedy. Even just marketing yourself as a stand-up comedian was somehow baffling to certain critics and audiences, which is its own obstacle.
Understandable. One of the things that it seems your lecture gets into are the unique challenges that Jewish women faced, specifically the kinds of stereotypes people would have about them. You just mentioned, of course, women in general were stereotyped in that they were thought to be more of a novelty act than their male counterparts. What were some of the issues that Jewish women, Jewish comedians in particular, faced?
So, you know, early stand-up comedy was disproportionately representative of Jewish men. When you think about the people that are associated with, like, the first big stand-up comics, you know, Henny Youngman, Jackie Mason, the list goes on. It's a lot of Jewish men. And it's a lot of Jewish men who are complaining about the women in their lives, their Jewish mothers, and their Jewish wives. And these stereotypes became so widely circulated that I've met people who they might have never met a Jewish person before, but they still know what the Jewish mother stereotype is. And so always, before Jean Carroll or Joan Rivers or any Jewish woman even opens her mouth, there is already that sort of ghost of the Jewish mother or the Jewish princess, or, you know, people have really strong stereotypes of what Jewish women are like that are haunting that microphone before the performer even opens her mouth.
How did early comedians work with that, deal with that, acknowledge it, and then move forward from it?
Well, I think part of the strategy is to humanize it. You know, they don't pretend that these expectations don't exist. Sometimes they'll even lean into the expectations. So, I mean, Joan Rivers is really well known for acknowledging the stereotypes about Jewish women, and sometimes even leaning into them. If you listen to, like, the record What Becomes a Semi-Legend Most, she has this really incredible bit where she roasts a woman in the audience for having too small an engagement ring. And she says, wait, are you Jewish? And the woman says, yes. And she says, well, then you have no excuse for accepting a ring that small. And she's just acting out this kind of stereotypical expectation of Jewish women. But she's doing it, I think, to show that she's in on the joke and that she's sort of mocking that expectation. And she's giving it a face. She's giving it a personality beyond simply this kind of monstrous idea. And I think that was an interesting thing that a lot of comedians were doing. When you humanize a stereotype, when you attach a face and a likable character persona to it, you take away a little bit of its fearsome quality.
It's interesting hearing you describe that, because to me, parts of this mirror the conversations around the marvelous Mrs. Maisel itself. There is, of course, a camp who finds this show. Very empowering, very interesting to learn about, you know, some aspects of the 1950s. Of course, it is fictional, but there are some real life people who are represented in it. And then there's another camp of people who I think believe it promotes some stereotypes. It does deal in some stereotypes. How do you view that? How do you view the critiques of this program and ultimately the merits?
I mean, I will say that there is a part of me who was just so like thrilled with the same kind of zealous joy that I see little girls exhibiting towards Disney princesses, thrilled to see a story that was really resonating in a mainstream way, that was about a Jewish woman being opinionated, being funny, being a comedian. To think that there were millions of Americans who were receptive to this story, it's really meaningful as a Jewish woman. And then, you know, you realize, well, Americans are receptive to this story if the woman is not portrayed in a way that challenges their idea of what Jews and Jewish women are like. You know, I think The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel was a wonderful show. And yeah, I mean, it supported some stereotypes, but I don't think in a really harmful way.
Sure. Now, as we look at female Jewish comedians today, who are the women you see who are carrying this same torch for this generation and the next?
Thank you for asking that question. I'm so excited about how many amazing Jewish women are doing work today. I just saw an incredible Netflix special by Jacqueline Novak, who is brilliant. I'm a really big fan of Sass Goldberg, who is a comedian and also a producer. Of course, Sarah Silverman is legendary and incredible. I'm also really excited about Rachel Bloom and the work that she's doing. Tiffany Haddish is brilliant and had an amazing special called Black Mitzvah, which is all about, not all, but largely about her life as a Black Jewish woman and the ways that that has been difficult to navigate. And I think, you know, with Tiffany Haddish and Rain Pryor, I mean, there are so many Black Jewish women in comedy. I mean, Rashida Jones, there are a lot of women whose that hasn't really been part of what they've discussed, but it's definitely part of their background. And so I'm excited for people to get into that and sort of expand their understanding of what Jewish women comedians look like.
For sure. Well, Grace, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect. And we're excited to have you here in Milwaukee.
Well, thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Grace Kessler Overbeck is an assistant professor of comedy writing and performance at Columbia College. She'll be in Milwaukee tomorrow evening for a lecture at UWM called The Many Mrs. Maisels, The History of Jewish Female Stand-Up Comedians. We want to hear from you as we gear up to cover local elections and the presidential election in November. You can have a say in our 2024 election coverage by filling out our election survey. You can find a link at WUWM.com. What you tell us will help inform the stories you hear on Lake Effect and WUWM. In about 15 minutes, we'll learn about Golda Meir, the first female prime minister of Israel, and how her time living in Milwaukee influenced her political activism. But first, we'll learn about the Bad River Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa, and their battle against the Line 5 pipeline. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. A new documentary film features the Bad River Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa, and their battle against the Line 5 pipeline. They're up against the Canadian energy company Enbridge, which uses the pipeline to shuttle oil from Western Canada through the Great Lakes and back up to Eastern Canada. On its way, 12 miles of pipe run through the Bad River Reservation. It's a fight the band says is necessary to defend Lake Superior from the aging pipeline and to protect the lake for future generations. According to the film, it's only the latest chapter in the tribe's long fight for sovereignty. WUWM's Lena Tran is joined by Mary Mazio, the producer, writer, and director of the new film, Bad River. They're also joined by Running Horse Livingston, a member of the Bad River Band featured in the film.
How did work on this film begin? You know, what was it about the story that grabbed you?
I had been called many years ago after my very first film by a Native American coach from Tuba City, Arizona. And he said, I can't get any of my young Native athletes to be recruited. I think a project would go a long way to dispelling stereotypical assumptions. I was a young filmmaker, couldn't immediately find funding for it. And then coming off of my last project, Grant Hill, who's my partner, Grant, and I said, you know, I think on the heels of A Most Beautiful Thing, I think it's time. And I would love to find sort of an extraordinary Native story that we could amplify voices from that community. And long story short, I had a chance encounter with former chairman of the Bad River Band, Mike Wiggins. He explained what was happening both with the band in terms of its current challenges over Line 5, but he also began to explain sort of the profound connectivity that he had and that the band has to the ecosystem, to the water, to the waterways, to the pristine aquifers. He said, so do you want to come out for some canoe diplomacy? I was like, I don't know what canoe diplomacy is, but I love it. When I came out to meet Mike, he said, you're going to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning. He took me to Waverly Beach and I'm following him. And he says, okay, stand here. And he proceeds to go halfway down the beach. And I'm like looking around, it's dark. I'm like, am I supposed to be feeling something? I don't know what's happening. Typical non-native, right? Like the sun begins to rise and break over Lake Superior. And it was spellbinding. You know, time stood still. I now understand what he was doing by having me join him in that morning exercise, which was to experience what it is that he and the Bad River Band have been fighting to protect, not just now, but before time began and long after time will end. It was a moment of magnitude for me.
He's showing you the waters that are so important to their tribe that are at risk from this pipeline that you mentioned. For people who are new to the story, can you kind of give a brief account of how we got here?
In the late 1940s, there was all kinds of exploration happening in Canada. They happened upon a huge vein of oil in Leduc, Canada. Thus began, how do we move oil from Western Canada to Eastern Canada? What ended up happening was a pipeline was constructed from the western side of Canada. It came down through the Great Lakes and then back to Sarnia in Canada. And the reason the pipeline did not go from Western Canada to Eastern Canada was it was cheaper to go through the United States. The permitting was easier and faster. The Bureau of Indian Affairs, the BIA at that time in the 50s, you had relocation underway. You also had termination, where tribal communities and tribal status was actually being terminated. And so there was this massive push to push Native peoples off their land. And it meant that the land all of a sudden was available for all kinds of commercial extraction, for pennies on the dollar, often free, often completely subsidized and rubber stamped by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And in 1953, the line had already come down under the Great Lakes, and then it was going to go back up, and it was constructed along 12 miles of the Bad River Reservation. There is no evidence that the band ever consented, and the amount paid for 20 years was less than $3,800. So this is just what was happening, not just here, but everywhere you had Native land in the 50s, right? Pipelines, mines, dams, all throughout Indian country.
You know, I think some people maybe will come to this film being like, I am here for the story about the pipeline and like the fight that's happening today. But the film, in fact, spends a lot of time documenting all of that history of displacement, of U.S. tribal relations. You know, why was it important to you to frame the story here as bigger in scope?
Honestly, I came to this thinking, what an epic David and Goliath story. But what happened is that we began interviews with tribal elders. And they started talking about not only this current chapter, they wanted to talk about how they themselves or their parents stood up to the mining. They wanted to talk about treaty rights, boarding schools. When elders started speaking with such a sense of pride about just this amazing genetic trait of fighting, of refusing to back down, like this film meandered. And so I was like, you know what? That's the story. And the chairman said one interesting thing to me in his interview. And he said, you know, Mary, we do not define ourselves through an Enbridge lens. Really, this challenge with Line 5 is only a chapter of the many, many stories that Bad River members shared. And, you know, long after this challenge, there will be another one, because that's just the history of who we are as a country. A perfect case in point, Running Horse. All of a sudden, he starts talking about my Uncle Clyde. And I'm like, your Uncle Clyde? And he says, yeah, and my uncle did this. And I'm thinking, is this Clyde Bellecourt who founded the American Indian Movement? Like, what?
Well, yeah, Running Horse, your family history comes up. In the film, you share that you heard stories from him, your aunt, grandmother, mother growing up. How did hearing those stories influence you?
So I feel like family really sort of forms your who you are from the inside out. And so the memories that I have back then from Minneapolis as a child, you know, it was attending marches, attending rallies and protests. And I understood that we were fighting for something that was valuable. But again, I didn't realize how valuable that was until I was a bit older. Now I appreciate the fact that my family was as involved as we were. And then I remember taking my own children to a rally. It was for the mascot issue. And we went to the Minnesota Vikings were, you know, so of course we all grew up in Minneapolis. We're playing the Washington football team. We marched down University Avenue in Minneapolis, which is like one of the main streets in Minneapolis. It was crazy, like to see that many people. And I remember my kids having the same look I did when I was a kid, you know, the big eyes and the looking around like, what is happening? You understand that you're part of something big and that it's important, because you see people getting up to speak and you hear, you know, the crowd roar and you hear, you know, all the people that are excited to be there. And I think it was maybe within a few years that they finally decided to change the name with a bit of pressure from corporate America. The thing about generational trauma, which a lot of Indigenous people have, is that there's a flip side to that. So like generational experiences and traits, I think, are also transferred. You know, I really wanted my children to experience that side of humanity, that it's always good to stand up for what you believe in and always stand up for what's fair. And I think that's really important.
I'd love to hear from both of you on this one. What do you hope people take away from the film?
You know, you go on these journeys as a filmmaker. I'm your prototypical American individualist, like, how far can I go? Not we go, how far can I go, right? And that's, I think, imbued in so many of us as part of our culture. Seeing the generosity, seeing the collective care in this community, I thought, boy, if this project can prompt more of us that are non-Native into doing a little bit more for each other, a little bit more for the generations to come, that would translate into a longer term, more holistic viewpoint that could just benefit us all.
There's a lot I hope people take away from the film. I think the first takeaway, obviously, is understanding what this fight is really about. The Bad River watershed is, there's only one Lake Superior on the planet. And if we don't protect that as the largest source of fresh water, I mean, the watershed is so critical. And if it gets poisoned at all, it's not just Bad River's loss. It's the entire country's loss. It's the only one on the planet. And so it's really a loss to the planet. I think that's what people don't understand. It's this small tribe in Wisconsin, northern Wisconsin, that's facing this fight. And so it's their issue. You know, I think in our country, we sort of take it for granted, the access we have to water. It's not a tragedy until it's gone. You know, people don't pay attention until there's tragedy. That's what we're trying to avoid. We don't want to be having these interviews because we're dealing with this big spill that's going to create such a huge mess. That's the conversation we don't want to have. I think the second takeaway is who we are as a people. And I think for Indigenous people all over the world, we're stewards of the earth. I think that part of our culture gets sort of lost on people who don't understand or have that connection. And when people ask me about, well, how can people be tied to the land? That just seems kind of a romantic thing to say about Indigenous people. But when you compare it to, for example, like the home you grew up in as a child, every person remembers everything about their childhood home. They remember all the rooms and all the little nooks and crannies and all the little pieces of wood on the stairs or where they got a sliver one time, or, you know, they have these memories that are tied to this space. That's what Indigenous people's connection to the land is. It's like that home that they grew up in, but it's been for way longer, I mean, millennia, and it's a wider space. But we know all of the nooks and crannies. We know all of the ins and outs of the land. And so it is our home. It's very much like a home that way to us. And so, you know, I think understanding that about Bad River people, that we are tied to the land and it is our home, and we're fighting this battle for water, but it's really a battle for our home and keeping it safe and keeping it beautiful the way that it has been for forever.
It does bear repeating that where the meander is carving, where the Bad River is carving a new course for herself, she's headed right for the pipeline. Judge William Connolly found that there could be a rupture with the next big flood. This is a very, very precarious situation happening in real time. And I love, Running Horse, that you said, you know, we don't want to have this conversation post-rupture. And so I think the band is really fighting. It's fighting for its life. It's also fighting for our collective lives in terms of that water resource and this brink of what could be really catastrophic. And the fortitude and strength of this small group of people really waging this fight single-handedly is extraordinary.
Mary Mazzio is the producer, writer, and director of the new film Bad River. She was joined by Running Horse Livingston, a member of the Bad River Band. They spoke with WUWM's Lena Tran. The film starts screening soon in Chicago, Ashland, and Madison. Golda Meir was Israel's fourth prime minister and the only woman to hold that post to date. The 2023 film Golda depicts Meir's time as prime minister during the Yom Kippur War in 1973. While Meir is best known for her five decades in Israeli politics, her legacy lives on in Milwaukee, with places like Golda Meir Elementary School or the library on UW-Milwaukee's campus. That's because she spent her formative years in Milwaukee after her family moved here from Russia. Marin Medzini not only knows about Meir's time in Milwaukee, he also served as her spokesman during the 1973 war. He was a consultant on the film and wrote an extensive political biography on Meir. Medzini joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to talk about Golda Meir. He begins by explaining what led her to leave Milwaukee to pursue political activism in Israel.
What sort of future can a young Jewish girl growing up in Wisconsin, let's say around First World War, before women had the right to vote in America, what does the future hold for me? At best, I can be a teacher, I can be a clerk, a nurse, a hat maker, a sales clerk at some department store. Nothing very exciting. And she already saw for herself a far better future. Therefore, she realized, not here. I'll have to go away, and two things will happen. I will go to Palestine. I will become one of the founders or lay the foundations for a future Jewish state. In the process, I will build myself. And this is basically what happened. She built herself, her career, and eventually she reached the top. So she loved America. She had very, very strong feelings about America, especially Wisconsin, which is a beautiful state. She loved the lakes, the greenery, the space, the freedom, democracy, the unions, and so on. But she came to the conclusion, this is not a place where I can fulfill my dreams, my ambitions. The one who objected to the whole thing was her husband. He did not believe in the idea of a Jewish state. He thought he would convince her she would outgrow this madness. She thought she would convert him. Well, she did in certain respect. And they married. She went back to Milwaukee, finished school, did 2 years teacher's training. In fact, did some teaching for new immigrants in America. I think she taught them English. And 1921, a new chapter, a group of 20, 21 people got on a boat in New York, among them my mother, and Golda and her older sister, children of her older sister. And 2 months later, they landed in Tel Aviv.
Before they got on the boat to return to Tel Aviv, she was a part of the Milwaukee Labor Zionist Party, right? When she went to what is now UW-Milwaukee becoming a teacher?
That's right.
How did the Labor Zionist Party influence what she would take back to shape her own political career in Israel?
Very much so. Basically, ideology. I omitted to say something else. Golda was apparently from very early age, she began to develop an acute sense of social justice. She was not religious in any way, more than secular. She smoked on the Sabbath. She drove on the Sabbath. She loved Chinese food. But her ideas were essentially nationalist, Zionist, secular, progressive, socialist.
So I imagine you came to know Golda through your mother long before you were her spokesperson from 1973 to 74, right?
My first memories of Golda were from mid-1930s. A rasping voice, always with a cigarette in her hand. And my mother quite often used to travel to Tel Aviv to see her sister. She was at my wedding later on, and always flowers and gifts and congratulations. Children were born. We were at the wedding of her children. In terms of relationship, I think she was the closest and sort of a confidant of my mother. She knew, Golda, that she could confide in my mother her innermost secrets and nothing would leak out.
So when you did come to have a relationship with Golda as someone working with her in her cabinet, what were your impressions of her as a leader, as a speaker? How did she present herself in this way?
Look, she became one of the top, 15, 20 leaders of the country already in 1930, when she was one of the founders of the leading labor party. It was called Mapai. And she was lucky in the sense that the leadership of the Jewish community of Palestine, the labor leadership, were very impressed with her when a year after she arrived, mainly because of her ability to communicate in Yiddish originally, and very much so in English. And therefore, at age 23, 24, she was already playing some political role with very poor Hebrew, but they were very impressed. They realized they have an asset, From 1928 on, she became secretary of the Women's Workers' Council and then member of the executive of the trade union, which was a very powerful instrument at the time, working very closely with the future leaders of Israel. She did not really contribute much to the Zionist socialist ideology. She was less of a thinker than a doer. But as a doer, she showed the capacity to fulfill virtually any role, and people knew that she was reliable. Now, all this came at the expense of family life.
She spent nearly her whole life in political involvements of some sort. She rose to prime minister of Israel. You served with her in 1973 and 74, and this period was also marked by the Yom Kippur War. And the movie Golda depicts this period of the war. Helen Mirren portrays Golda Meir. You also served as a consultant on this film. So what did you feel were the most important things the filmmakers needed to know about Golda and her experiences during the Yom Kippur War?
In helping out on the film, I was joined by my son. My son organized Zoom conferences with the director, who was an Israeli, who was born shortly after the Yom Kippur War. He read my book. I did a very long political biography of Golda Meir. He read it. He read other books on Golda, and he said to me, "I know the history. I don't know Golda. Would you please tell me how she operated? Style. She was calm. She was collected. No shouting. No screaming. No loss of temper. Two packs a day of cigarettes, endless cups of coffee. She did not read material. Interestingly enough, she did not go over documented, diplomatic document and other, partly because her Hebrew was not that good, partly because already then she had some cataract problems. She gained her information from being told. There were people there who told her what was happening, and she relied heavily on what they would tell her, knowing that they will not betray her. She knew how to ask the right questions. If she was annoyed with you, she'd give you a dirty look. She'd look you in the eye, and you understood that you were out of place, and very, very quickly you came to order. But apart from that, no jokes. And she was operating basically in an area full of men. And look, the war lasted over 3 weeks. And she was not treated for cancer during the time. Normally she would get once a week chemotherapy, and she held out. She held out extremely well. Now, she ran the war in the following manner. A small group, 5 people, an inner cabinet or a war cabinet. And she began to make decisions, tactical, strategic, foreign policy, relations with Kissinger and Nixon, while maintaining a close control of the home front. Above all, her policy during the war, they started the war, they have to pay for it, they have to be punished. At some point, she realized maybe there is hope that a greater change is in the offing. She had been accused for many years in Israel as being rigid, intransigent, inflexible, all sorts of terrible things, because partly her own penchant for secrecy. And she had a saying, if and when the archives would be open, people will see how far I was prepared to go.
As you said, these impressions of Golda are still controversial today for some people, for some Israelis. How do you hope this look at the film could change or enlighten others? Because most people may not go looking for the archives.
It will change. Look, during the war, I was her spokesman. I was an unemployed spokesman. Second day of the war, she called me in. She said, no interviews, none at all. And I had piles of requests. I tried to argue, which of course was useless. And at some point she said to me, don't you know there's a war on? And that was it. She refused adamantly to be interviewed. I can imagine why. She was afraid of people asking, why weren't you prepared? Why was Israel caught by surprise and so on? And therefore, in terms of boosting morale during the war, I can't say that she contributed much. Curiously enough, overseas, especially in the United States, she was always the queen of Israel, the queen of the Jews. In Israel, younger generation raised and taught to question her wisdom. Some people said she was half literate. Some people said she was illiterate. Others said that she failed to understand the reality. Part of the tragedy was at age 71, when she became prime minister, you don't change. Views that she had of Arabs for years and years remained more or less the same. And in this respect, she was pessimistic. She was not the only one. Entire leadership, starting with Ben-Gurion, we've got to rely only on ourselves. No one else will save us if something goes wrong. And therefore, many Israelis, young Israelis, felt that she was, in fact, blocking the possibility, remote possibility of peace. And we saw that in, especially in 1970, 71. Now it's turning around. Now younger Israelis, let's say my grandchildren, are beginning to get a totally different view. And in a certain respect, there is growing understanding and probably respect as well for what you did.
Well, Maron, I want to thank you so much for joining me today and sharing a little bit more about Golda Meir.
My pleasure.
Maron Medzini is a professor emeritus at the University of Jerusalem, former director of Israel's government press office, and the former spokesperson for Prime Minister Golda Meir. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski last September after the film Golda premiered. Marquette will hold an event this month to support DACA recipient students. We'll learn about that event and what it does for the students next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. DACA recipients, often called dreamers, came to the U.S. as children, and through the federal program can gain protection from deportation and can work legally, but they aren't eligible for federal financial aid. To help support dreamers, Marquette University is gearing up to celebrate its 9th annual Dreamers Gala. It's a student-led event that celebrates the accomplishments of DACA students and helps support their financial needs. To learn more about the community event, Lake Effect's Excret Nunez speaks with DACA recipient and student organizer for the gala, Lisbeth Landeros.
Marquette University is celebrating its 9th annual Dreamers Gala in March. And for those who aren't familiar with the gala, what can you tell me about the event?
So the annual Dreamers Gala consists of a celebration to honor the achievements and resilience of Dreamers students at Marquette, while also fundraising for the Ignacio Yacuria SJ Dreamers Scholarship.
And I understand that the gala is put on by students such as yourself to help raise funds for the Ignacio Yacuria SJ Dreamers Scholarship, like you mentioned. Can you tell me who this scholarship is named after and how does it support DACA students?
Yes, so the scholarship is named after Ignacio Yacuria, who was a Jesuit philosopher and a theologian. And he was missioned in El Salvador, but he's originally from Spain. He's known as having a significant contribution to the liberation philosophy, which focuses on liberating the oppressed in order to reach the fullness of humanity, but also proclaiming that the essence of being human demands that society is structured in a way that meets both physical and the biological needs of human beings. And in order for everyone to be able to enjoy the freedom and to dedicate our talents and efforts and to overall contribute to the construction of society.
So how does this scholarship named after him support DACA students?
So this, in a way, relates to the Jesuit beliefs of Marquette. So it's our main goal, like I said before, to recognize the dignity of every person, and more specifically, dreamers. And as you may or may not know, dreamers are not eligible for government aid and are very limited to the scholarships they can apply to. So the goal is just to bridge the gap between financial needs and help full-time Marquette students.
And I know this year's theme is Out of the Shadows. What does this theme mean, and how is it different from other years?
So last year's theme was Here to Stay. We try to have a new theme every year. And what this theme related to was recognizing the commitment that us as dreamers have to the United States as we acknowledge it as our home, despite the uncertainties that our immigration status creates. But this year specifically, we have the Out of the Shadows theme, and we want to recognize the need to create a greater visibility of challenges that us dreamers face, as well as symbolizing the spirit that we need to embrace our presence. And as I mentioned before, because of those continued uncertainties with our immigration status and the DACA program.
And what are some of the accomplishments that are celebrated?
Every year we also have a keynote speaker, so it's usually a Dreamer alumni student from Marquette. And this year specifically, we have Nancy Dariana Suarez Jimenez, who graduated in 2022 and is currently working as a caseworker for the Rock County Human Services, specifically working with children with special needs and their families. Keynote speakers basically talk about their upbringing, so starting from like childhood, kind of like a background, and then their development through their professional careers at Marquette. And we think this is important in order to showcase the influence that scholarship programs like Ella Curia and events like the Dreamers Gala can do for students.
And so, drawing from your own experience as a dreamer and a college student, what are some of the unique challenges or needs that young dreamers face?
I think for me specifically, a lot of it has to do with being or finding ways to communicate our needs. I think it's hard to open up with people, or you have to be careful with who you can open up and talk to. I think it has to do with the reaction you're going to get out of it. Like, you don't know if they're going to be able to help you or know what resources are open to you. So that's definitely one of the biggest. I would say now people are more educated on the topic, but I would say there's certain things that aren't as talked about. So, for example, bringing back the Dreamers Gala and the scholarship, like, what scholarships can we apply to? Like, what kind of aid are we eligible for? So those kinds of things.
Why is it important to you to highlight and attend this gala?
Well, I originally attended the Dreamers Gala when I was a sophomore in high school. And I think that kind of solidified my decision on applying and going to Marquette, because it's such, like, I feel like there's no words to explain, but it's a beautiful experience, and there's a lot of community members, so like staff, faculty, professors, students, people from different businesses that go and support. So just like seeing everybody come in into one place and like knowing that you have that amount of people there to support and acknowledge your hard work is very special.
And I want to bring it back to the beginning of the scholarship and gala. Why did it all start 9 years ago?
So it started back in 2016 by a group of students who wanted to create a scholarship for dreamers attending Marquette specifically. And in order to do so, they created what is now known as the annual Dreamers Gala, which is just like a fundraiser dinner. And as I mentioned before, this is because dreamers are not eligible for government aid and are very limited to the kinds of scholarships they can apply to. So their overall goal was just to be able to provide that additional financial support. And since then, thanks to all the support that we have received in the past 8 years, the Dreamers Gala has continued annually, even through COVID, which was virtually. And thanks to everything, we'll be celebrating our ninth annual Dreamers Gala this year.
Well, Lisbeth, thank you so much for speaking with me today and telling me more about this important event.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lisbeth Landeros is a DACA student at Marquette University and is helping organize the school's annual Dreamers Gala. She spoke with Lake Effect's Exgrit Nunez. Registration for the 9th annual Dreamers Gala closes on March 11th. The gala will take place on March 19th at Marquette University. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, you can download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow is the start of the Looking Ahead member drive at WUWM. We'll be sharing some of the many things we have in the works for 2024, including our election coverage and projects, the 20th season of Bubbler Talk, and our 60th birthday. Please join us tomorrow and throughout the week to learn more about all of that and how you can support the work we're doing right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.